you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi, my name is Danny Roth, and this is Everyday Horror. It's a podcast where we watch at least one movie for every day in the month of October, and then we talk about it. I am joined this week by the hosts of the Apocalypse Book Club, Antonella and Sarah, and Raven Jacobowski. Hello.
Hello. Hi, Danny. Always a pleasure to come on board and watch a scary movie.
It's a thing that I like to do, I guess. What movie did we watch? What movie did we choose?
We watched The Last Man on Earth, the original adaptation of Matheson's novel, I Am Legend.
Yes, the 1964 classic starring Vincent Price.
Because if there's one thing we of the Apocalypse Book Club can't get away from, it's one man surviving the end of the world and society as we know it collapsing and disappearing.
Yeah, this is our third Last Man this year.
Wow, quality. So why was that the reason that you picked it? Which one of you picked it?
I picked it. I came at it mainly for everyone needs a little Vincent Price in their life.
Oh, yeah.
I think this is a pretty good Vincent Price. A lot of talking over just him doing stuff. But it has a warm place in my heart.
Yeah, it was interesting. This was my first time watching it. Watching that whole opening sequence, which has a lot of voiceover, I thought to myself, would we do the voiceover if we made this movie today?
I need you to imagine I Am Legend with Will Smith with voiceover. And I think the answer is, this is a terrible idea. Let's never do this again. But because it's Vincent Price, we'll allow it.
I just don't feel like it would be quite the same with Will Smith going like, woo! I'm the last man on earth, getting jiggy with it.
Remember, he can't let go of that reason. Reason's the only thing he has going for himself right now.
Yes. Anyway, all right. So it's kind of got an interesting backstory, this film, to kind of contextualize it a little bit. So the book was written in the 1950s. The movie came out 10 years later in 1964. The people behind making it had wanted to do something that was sort of a post-apocalyptic horror for a while, but things kind of kept coming up, most notably that a different film called The World, the Flesh, and the Devil came out in 1959, and then eventually they were like, I guess we're not going to make this other movie that they were going to do, which was called Earth Abides. And then the other thing that happened was that this movie was also going to be a Hammer horror, which would have been a very different sort of motion picture.
Hey, Danny.
Yes?
What's a Hammer horror?
So Hammer horror is a British production company. They're known for the Peter Cushing Frankenstein movie. They are known for... basically, most of the Christopher Lee Dracula movies are them. They've basically, if there's a classic movie monster, they've done it. They tend to be a little bit wackier, certainly as you get further into the 60s, 70s, they become a bit more lurid, let's say, a little like not pornographic, but like you see some titties and such, and like they think that that's clever. I don't know. I enjoy Hammer horror, but it was a different time. The 1950s and 1960s were a different era for Britain, and so there was a censorship issue. They didn't want to make this particular film, so it was rejected, and so it wound up with American producers, so they made it, and Matheson did a first pass. He did the first script, and the final version that went out, he was so disappointed by it that he used a pen name instead of his actual name and said a lot of really interesting things over the years about this particular story and what he would have preferred to have happen, people that he would have preferred to have been attached. So he thought that this was a very boring version. He thought that Vincent Price was completely miscast. And, you know, I think was very quick to say, like, I really like Vincent Price in general. I just don't think that he was right for this particular role. And at some point in the late 90s, he even said that the person that was correct for the role was Harrison Ford, and that it was George Miller, director of The Road Warrior, and, of course, Mad Max Fury Road, that should have been the director. Interesting fact that he had said this, I think, in 1999, and that really the last thing that that George had done was Babe, Pig in the City. So I don't know if he was like, man, I watched that Babe, Pig in the City and was like,
nailed it.
That's the one. That's the guy who's got to do this story about the apocalypse.
Post-apocalyptic, one man survives and becomes the monster of a new society.
And so, all right. And that is kind of, I feel like, that's the crux. Like, that's the big discussion point. I find that this story is permanently relevant.
I think the twist in this version is much more faithful to the novella than the... Is there even a twist in the Will Smith version?
There's the slightest of implications that the monsters are not as monstrous as they seem, but not a realization on his end at all.
Yeah, and I don't know.
I think there's an alternate take where he kind of like realizes it right at the tail end a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know that we get to see the monsters reacting to Will Smith the way that we get to see them reacting to Vincent Price in this version. And that's pretty nice.
Or even just the fact that they can obviously communicate.
And yes.
They are thinking beings.
What did you think of the film sort of overall? Like, what was your impression of it? What do you think that Vincent Price was miscast, or did you like his performance?
It grew on me. He's got such a distinctive voice and acting style.
No, he's a true everyman.
Yeah. So it's a little hard to see him as the hero. I guess in that way, the twist really works for him because he's already a little bit creepy. You can see him as creepy. So it's not crazy that this new society might make him their boogeyman. It's always funny going back this far and looking at horror from mid-century because it's not at all like modern horror. You don't have jump scares. You don't have... It's a lot closer to a modern thriller, I guess, in a lot of ways.
Can you put it in the context of apocalyptic fiction in general during the time? Like, what else was sort of coming out in novel form in the sort of like 1940s through 1960s?
Yeah, you do start getting this. I mean, you mentioned Earth Abides, which is one of my favorite stories. And Earth Abides has a very similar feel. You follow a last man on Earth who discovers he's not the absolutely last man on Earth, but there aren't very many people left. And you follow him and his found family into the future. And I think that this is interesting in that genre because it's a plague versus apocalyptic nuclear horror, which is what we were starting to get a lot of coming out of the 50s. And I think in that way, it is a different kind of horror because it's this sort of fear of the unknown, not fear of a literal bomb.
I also find it interesting that you get this sort of story of, no, a plague killed us all, when we're so deep in the age of penicillin and the miracle of antibiotics. And in the 60s, like, you make this movie about, but this disease in particular, we have no solution for. I mean, I'm going to tell you, like, sometimes I was getting a lot of like, oh man, AIDS, right? Like, hey, we can sort of contain it, but we can't cure it.
But I think what's sort of, I mean, in this sense, as far as I ever understood it, is that this is not really, I mean, it's not really about an actual illness at all. It's about the changing mores of culture, right? He represents a bygone era, and these people represent the future of where things are going. And I think that's especially relevant. I think it makes a lot of sense why a film like this would be made in the 1960s. It makes a lot more sense in the 60s even than the 50s, frankly, because that is really like the first really huge cultural revolution in a way that was happening like with literally everyone everywhere. It's like, I guess you could argue it's like 1920s and then
yeah,
I 1960s.
Think what's interesting about this, you mentioned that it inspired Night of the Living Dead.
It did.
And you can see Night of the Living Dead is a statement on society. And this is also a statement on society. You've got this old generation who can't even see the new generation as people, is actually hunting them down and killing them because he assumes that they are monsters. And it's a pretty tough watch in the year of our Lord 2018. That allegory is no less accurate and relevant.
Yeah, it's very stressful. A thing that I find to be kind of weird about this movie is how much time we spend in what is his present day before they get around to going back. Because we're so used to the modern convention where if you're going to do some kind of flashback, be it in television or film, it's done in sort of drips and drabs, right? Where it's like, here's the modern day, here's a throwback, and when we come back, there's a relevant sort of counterpoint to what's happening. Whereas in this film, you get, like, the whole first act is present, and then, like, the entire second act is past, and then the whole third act, for the most part, is present again. Was that sort of weird for you? What was your impression of that? How did you feel about that?
I really liked the pacing. It worked for me. The voiceover in the beginning was a little weird. I kind of wish they'd let us be quiet with him for a while and just watch his daily routine and wonder what this guy was doing and why his house looks this messy and what's going on. Why does he have a fridge full of garlic?
It makes me think of Dune. Because the Dune, the original version doesn't really have a lot of that. But when they decided to go back to try to make it more clear, they added a lot of voiceover to it. And I mean, that's clearly the reason why they did it here, because they didn't trust the audience.
Yeah, I
also feel like it definitely was affected by the fact that it had a Roman Italian director. It's filmed in and around Rome. There were a lot of parts, just the way they were framed and the pacing of it, where it was like, I've seen this Italian movie. Which I think might have also, I mean, if it was so unpopular in its day, I mean, people liked Italian art movies in that time, but it's an interesting combination with the story because they do definitely, it gets so contemplative, but then they throw that voiceover over, and I would love to know whose decision that was. Was it always there, or was it just, nobody knows what he's doing.
Get a
voiceover in there.
Yeah.
I think there's also an element of like, well, we've got Vincent Price. You know who's got a really distinct and interesting voice? Vincent Price.
Especially as leading up to the filming of this movie, he would have been in a lot of Edgar Allan Poe makes and movies. Yeah, he would. I just find that really interesting that was his wheelhouse right in that period. And then let's go to, you know, Apocalypse.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to sort of look at this film versus what it is that I think that people perceive Vincent Price as playing, because he doesn't traditionally play a gallant hero. It's not really his type. He really is sort of like one of the OG masters of horror, and usually as a result is sort of like this guy that will introduce a thing to you. You know, he's almost strangely, he eventually became almost like a Rod Serling or like a Crypt Keeper, you know, and always, I think, had that particular quality where you can't trust him. And he's still, I mean, like, it's weird because is he a villain in the end? How do we view him? Because he's a tragic figure.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a way that it differs from the novella, is that in this, he cures the woman who has come to spy on him. He cures her of her vampiredom. And the movie leaves that hanging, but I think that it was their last ditch attempt to say, but he really is a hero, and he's sorry that you thought that he was a monster. He didn't know, and he has regrets, and he would like to fix it, please. And then he gets murdered anyway, in a bit of like a Quasimodo situation, because he goes into this church, and I almost expected him to scream sanctuary. I really wanted that.
I mean, even in his dying breath, he still, though, lambasts them like, I was the man. Like, you don't, I was the man.
You're all freaks.
Yeah. Like, and I get like, hey, you got a spear in your gut, man. That's rough.
Yeah, yeah, I would be pretty mad.
It's almost like he's gone off the rails on Twitter and everybody's like sending like that, like,
yeah,
gif, like, come on, bro. I think it's interesting. There are a number of changes from the book. In addition, I think two other things that are very interesting. One is that, in fact, the vampire zombies are not shamblers. They are very fast in the novella. And also, he's not a scientist.
Yeah, that's probably the most important difference from the original novella to any adaptation, I think.
Yeah, it's very common for him to be a sort of learned man of science. That is true in the Will Smith version as well. And yeah, he was just a kind of a lowly plant worker in the novella.
And also, it's not just that he's now a man of science in so many of the adaptations. It's that he's a man of science or of government or something that was working towards either the cure or keeping society together. Like, they had a hand in it somehow. I mean, you even see that in the I Am Legend Will Smith version. I haven't seen Omega Man.
Me neither.
So, but if I were a betting person, I'd say Charlton Heston probably is a man of some kind of science in that.
But if you think about it, once you get onto the adaptation of Body Snatchers, you're dealing with the health department again. What a convenient solution that your main character is employed by the very branch of government that's being affected by this apocalypse.
I mean, I guess for adaption-wise, it does allow you that shorthand of, well, my character would just know stuff.
Yeah, it saves you a lot of exposition. Also, like, he doesn't have to read about it in the paper.
He doesn't
just
have
knows
to go
it.
To the library.
Yes.
But we do so love a library trip.
I would have loved a library montage.
What do you think of this idea of Harrison Ford and George Miller that was proposed by Matheson?
The minute you said it was late 90s, I thought, oh, he saw Harrison Ford in The Fugitive. And he thought, here's a guy who can act really desperate and run away from stuff. He would be great at this.
Yeah. They probably would have kept the fast, not zombies.
Played by Tommy Lee Jones.
As Ben.
But only if then he's like early Raiders Indiana Jones with the glasses and the bow tie.
Yeah.
He has to keep that bow tie like the whole movie until the real climactic bit where he's about to die because he's a monster and he rips the bow tie off.
Oh, he's taking the bow tie off like it's the 11th Doctor turning into the 12th? Wow.
Yeah, because like he's lost all visages of his humanity. He's a monster now. He's lost the bow tie.
You wouldn't kill a man with a bow tie.
I am kind of curious if you were going to tell, because like, all right, so two things. One, there is a thing, or there was a TV show called The Last Man on Earth that was recently canceled, that was a Will Forte comedy wherein a man believes himself to be the last living human being after a plague. And then it turns out there are other people, but they're all idiots. And it is a comedy, but it is also deeply tragic often. And I wonder if, in its way, if it is an actual fair inheritor to what the story is, if you're going to tell it now, is that the way to do it? And if not, how does one tell this particular narrative in 2018?
I mean, I think that there's a way to tell this story as a comedy, which is a thing that I would watch, where you've got a human living in an apartment building and all of his neighbors and the rest of the city are vampires. And he's like, oh, just taking out my garbage. And it's like milk cartons. And he throws it down next to garbage full of IV bags. I don't know. I'm afraid if you try to tell this story now, what you actually get is Daybreakers.
Oh, right. That is a movie that exists.
It is.
I mean, it's not from today. That movie came out like a decade ago? I don't know. I'm old.
I mean, it's more from today than Last Man on Earth.
What's that? Is that Ethan Hawke in that one?
I believe it is. I did watch it once. It was a vampire apocalypse.
It was. Do you want to critique this movie? Because there are some flaws. There are some things about the movie that don't really add up, that don't really make... Like, I don't... Like, look, it's a... I think what's interesting about it is that it wasn't particularly successful. Like, it wasn't beloved when it came out. The book was not entirely beloved when it came out. However, It has sort of aged well, like a fine wine. It is now fondly looked at as a classic, and I think that is because we sort of go, well, it's old, so like it was dumb because the 60s are dumb, which is not really true. But I think, you know, like once there's a certain number of decades in the rear view, you go, well, it was a different time. But it is a flawed film. What would you say? What is a really glaring point of contention for you in the way that the story is executed?
Why wasn't he growing his own goddamn garlic? Why? Why was he keeping it in the freezer?
Accurate.
I mean,
and he keeps going back to like where is the garlic coming from?
Well, he goes to a grocery store
where he's keeping it in the freezer. Wouldn't that stuff go bad? Wouldn't it go bad at the grocery store?
For 3 years, it's in a refrigerator at the grocery store. That stuff is rotten.
All you had to do was show me the garden he put in his backyard and the garlic he's growing there, and like, fine. And then just show me the garden, and then it could be like, well, this is what I harvested and I got to keep until next season, so let me put it on ice. Fine. Okay. Fine. But you got to show me that. He's a man of science. Don't tell me he hasn't taken up agriculture in the meanwhile. It's been 3 years.
I was wondering if maybe you could just like plant a fence of garlic, just edge your, like one of those invincible fences that you used to keep your dogs in. What if you just planted garlic around the perimeter of your property?
And they give you such beautiful, like weird Seussian flowers. It looks like a Dr. Seuss tree. It's great. I love a good allium.
You've got your landscaping and your vampire proofing all in one plant.
Yeah.
My criticism is move. It is the thing that, because the whole deal is that like, once you get into the second act where we're backtracking and finding out like what really happened, we are introduced to this character, Ben, who is like the gang leader of the vampires that comes to his house. Like they were bros, they were buds. So he knows where Robert Morgan lives because they were buds. And I just kept thinking like, just move. Then he won't know where you are. Yeah. Just literally get another house. Get in your car, drive to the outskirts. They're not going to be able to find you. They could like hunt around. Maybe they get lucky. It seems pretty unlikely though.
Yeah.
Like just go hide out and rebuild someplace else. Like he spends this whole chunk of the movie wherein he's going block by block, trying to find where each of them is so that he can kill all of the vampire zombie critters. And it's like, you know, here's a thought. What if you made them do that work?
Yeah.
What if they did it instead of you and you could just kind of chill?
Well, this is his new hobby. His new hobby is killing vampires. And what gets me is like, okay, he's got this map and he's crossed off all of these blocks he's already hit. You know they can come in after, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not this like he's setting up garlic behind him, like with a big like police tape being like, do not enter again.
Yeah, they don't say he's like destroyed the buildings. Like he just goes, he kills them. He drops them off in a pit.
Full of fire.
Full of fire that just keeps going.
And meanwhile, I'm thinking, what if the vampires just get a map and are like, oh, I see his system. He's going block by block. Nobody be on this block this week.
Yeah.
Defeated.
Well, I think that's how the smart vampires have avoided him for 3 years.
Clearly.
Obviously.
They have a dress code. That gets me.
Oh, yeah, they do. They all dress in black.
They all dress in... The women are all wearing sensible black skirts. The men all in black turtlenecks.
I'm like, man, if I was part of, you know, a vampire society trying to rebuild the world, I hope we're not a weird cult. I just don't want to be part of a weird militaristic religious vampire cult at the end of the world.
I don't want to be part of any kind of cult. Like, I don't even want to be part of, like the apple-picking cults. Like, even those. It's like, I love apples, but I don't want to be in a cult where it's like, come get our apples. That's, like, still weird to me. Like, I don't know. Maybe this is too personal, but when I was a kid, that was my first blush with cults, as we'd go out and pick apples every autumn. And, like, most of the apple orchards were run by weird cults.
Was there, like, a Hare Krishna...
Kind of. I don't know what the deal was. Like, my mother would really clutch pearls about it. Like, she'd be like, don't talk to them, Daniel. You know, like...
Just take the apples and go.
Yeah.
What part of the world was this? You grew up in Jersey. I grew up in Jersey. Was this New York or was it in Jersey?
I believe it was still Jersey. I mean, it could have been, like, sort of a New York State kind of thing.
Like,
but
just cross the border real quick. And
maybe. There's a lot of, like, New Jersey's a weird place, and New York State can be a bit of an odd place. There are whole movies dedicated to how weird these regions of the Northeast Corridor can be. What I'm saying is, I hope that I'm not part of a vampire cult that has apples.
Look, if I was going to start a vampire cult,
yeah,
that grew apples, Catskills, I would go straight to the Catskills.
Okay.
It's beautiful. There's a lot of no one really doing anything up there. I feel like I could run a pretty successful little vampire/human resort for people.
All right.
I'm just saying.
What about you? How are you going to do your vampire cult?
My vampire cult? Well, the first thing you got to do is turn the fashion designers. I think that this movie made that pretty clear. You find all of the people with a really solid fashion sense, and they're the first ones you bring over. And then everything else sort of falls into place. You
know? All right, so then that leads to the next natural question, which is, are you going to do like a uniform kind of thing? Or what's your design choice? What's your aesthetic?
Well, I guess it depends on whether we are trying to sell our fashion to the outsiders or not. I think there's room for a lot of variety. Maybe a little enamel pin with our logo is all you need in the way of a uniform.
What's the logo?
Apple with
fangs.
Are
we growing apples? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm really committed to the to the apple commune now.
This is my fault. Why did I bring this up?
You had to bring fruit into this. It's a Bunnicula cult.
Wait, do bunnies like apples?
Bunnicula does.
Oh.
Jinx.
Y'all are nerds. So anyway, about these vampire cults, I don't know, man. Here's one other thing that really bugs me. And this is a running theme I find in horror movies. A horrible, horrible thing that happens. You introduce a lovable animal.
Yeah.
And this movie is like totally bizarre because obviously in the book, the deal is there's sort of this timid dog that kind of comes and goes, but that's it. Like, just kind of like, he's around. And in the Will Smith iteration, like, that's like his best bro. And not only does that dog die, but that dog gets turned and he has to do the killing. This dog, like, shows up and Vincent Price, like, chases after him, like, has been alone so long that he'll just take what he can get. And he's like, we're going to be best pals. And then the dog's dead. That's it. It's like 5 seconds later.
This actually raised another huge logic flag for me. Did this virus kill all life on Earth or turn it into vampires? Because the dog is infected and Vincent has to put it down almost immediately.
Yeah. What does he eat? Because he mentions it very briefly that he drinks coffee.
And orange juice.
And orange juice. Where are the oranges coming from?
I guess he's getting them all at the same grocery store that he's been raiding
he's
for
really
3 years.
He's really playing this apocalypse on easy mode, isn't he?
Yeah.
Like, if this is a video game, like, they don't really have, like, the mechanic for, like, craft building or farming.
Yeah,
like,
this is the Fallout easy where you don't actually have to sleep or eat.
Maybe he's so far gone, he just calls Tang OJ.
Oh, bless.
Yeah, like maybe that's how much he's lost. He's lost it.
I call it orange juice.
Because it's orange. It's an orange liquid.
You see what I did there?
But like, yeah, I don't know. I think about all this stuff. Like, where is the water coming from? Like, how is, like, does he just, like, is his plumbing working? Can he use the bathroom?
Why,
like,
is all of the gasoline still working?
Good,
and
right.
The cars,
oh,
have,
yeah, like, the gas
one.
Doesn't go bad? Like, come
that's
on.
That's my big one. Because I'm like, man. I know not to be that pedantic person, but gas goes bad.
This is a real that time period, though. Yeah. And one of the things I loved about Earth Abides, the novel, is that they actually talk about things like the rubber in the tires is going to go bad.
Yeah.
And I love that they acknowledge that because this movie is not concerned. Like, no. Yep, cars for the taken.
Yeah.
So Earth Abides, but you said there's like a group of people.
Eventually, yeah. You spend a long time with your protagonist in the beginning, and then he does find other survivors.
Yeah. I'm Spoiler. Trying to think of things you could recommend to somebody based on this. Like, let's say you watch this movie, you like it. I think that there's a good chance, or like there's at least a pearl in there, right? Like there's an element that you're like, ah, I like this, and I would like more of this type. What would you recommend to somebody? Let's say in this case, I mean, like it can be a movie, but I would say since your podcast is novel based, where would you send them?
Well, since I've already talked Earth Abides, I would say my next choice, if you don't mind it being a downer, would be On the Beach, a real classic of apocalyptic horror. It is also about a group versus a single person, but it deals with a lot of the same issues of what do you do when society is collapsing and running out of things, and how do you hold on to hope in that situation, which is a mainstay of all of most apocalyptic fiction. I think it's hard to find something that's both as kitschy as this movie and is apocalyptic.
I mean, I'm not as familiar with apocalyptic fiction as my cohort. I'm sort of coming into this like first go of a lot of it. But I can say that if you want, like, I'm sure everyone's read this already, but to me, World War Z is just really great for the, hey, you know, all those things you take for granted in society? Guess what? You're not going to get them anymore. And I've always really enjoyed how that book unpacks what you don't have when everything collapses.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And that's a thing this movie doesn't deal with at all.
Yep.
My recommendation, as always, for this kind of thing is the 1970s BBC Terry Nation series Survivors. There is not any real vampire or zombie element, but it is post-apocalyptic. It is a virus that ends most of humanity, and it is almost completely about, okay, so now what? There's not a lot of us left, and we're all deeply flawed. It is not a comedy. It is pretty depressing a lot of the time, but there are moments of genuine hope, and there are people who have sort of like exist, like they do encounter other people eventually who are, let's say, like especially not good as the series progresses. So, you know, instead of jumping to something like, let's say, The Walking Dead or Fear the Walking Dead or anything else that's completely modern, I would say The Survivors is a really great way to go because like this, it is kind of kitschy. It's very slow paced, but it's really taking the time to sort of root through a lot of the existential as well as the practical. And I think that that is a really exceptional series when you want to sort of ask those kind of questions and enjoy something that's kind of heady and a little hippie, to be honest.
Going back to movies, though, one that just came to mind, actually, that I saw back in 2006, it's I think it tries to think about a lot of those things, but just by the nature of, I think it's budget and reasons, there are some things where you're just like, that doesn't quite look right and doesn't feel right, but it's a movie called Ever Since the World Ended, which actually also starred Adam Savage from Mythbusters.
And I saw that one.
He plays himself, and he has this amazing scene where he goes into... in 5 years, I won't have any of this equipment I have. How we won't be able to make that. We won't be able to manufacture that. So what world am I leaving my kids? How can I set up the world as best I can so they can survive without the things I've gotten used to surviving with? And it's very much a group of people, I believe in San Francisco, the older ones are trying to hold on to what they can of society. And you see the younger kids sort of, they don't remember what it was, so why should they care?
San Francisco's a real hotbed of apocalypses.
Yeah.
And also, they got some really great shots, though, of you know, making San Francisco look abandoned. So that's another reason why I really, really like that movie.
Yeah.
It's a movie that, even though I haven't seen it in 12 years, it's one that I kind of keep coming back to in my brain. So.
Well, that is The Last Man on Earth. We'll be watching another movie tomorrow, and it will be, who knows. Thank you both for joining me. As we wrap up, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find our Apocalypse Book Club Twitter at ApocalypseC. My individual Twitter is Nelichronism.
And I'm on Twitter as Quoth a Raven.
And my name is Danny Roth, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N, Ordinary also with one N. Thank you for listening, and remember, sometimes the best cure for the horrors of every day is a little every day.